Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The Milwaukee Art Museum's current exhibit, Serious Play, Design in Mid-Century America, explores the work of some 40 designers who integrated concepts like playfulness and fun into their work for corporations, home interiors, and, yes, children.
It's a topic that connects strongly with the expertise of architecture critic and writer Alexander Lange. Lange's latest book is called The Design of Childhood: How the Material World Shapes Independent Kids. She spoke recently at the Art Museum, but also visited with Bonnie North, who asked her how design affects young people and the adults they become.
As adults, we design childhood by the choices that we make for our children. And, you know, those choices start from birth with the toys that we give them, how we decorate their rooms, what kinds of playgrounds we take them to, what kind of preschools we put them into. And all of those choices affect how children learn about the world. I particularly focus on how they learn about the world through physical actions, you know, moving their bodies, playing with toys, and then how they begin to see themselves as affecting the world. You know, the subtitle of my book is How the Material World Shapes Independent Kids, and that idea of independence, of kind of free thinking, really is a theme that runs through all of the materials and scales that I talk about in the book.
Well, do we really actually value independence? I mean, we say we do as a culture, but so much of society and culture is about fitting in, about not standing out. And so when you talk about independence, exactly what are you talking about?
Yeah, I'm talking about children making decisions for themselves, which, it's true, is not something that a lot of parents necessarily want, a lot of schools are necessarily fostering. But, you know, I've talked to a lot of people in education about the book, and they say, you know, is our educational system, you know, fostering independent thinking? We don't know what the future holds. And I feel like independent thinking is the only way to go if we don't know which way the future holds. You know, if we can't predict, you know, what the jobs will be in 10 years, you know, what artistic production will be like in 10 years, then the only thing we can do is produce, you know, children and individuals that know how to ask questions, that know how to investigate things. And that's what children are doing, you know, even from the earliest years when they're playing with blocks. They're investigating gravity. They're investigating colors and shapes and building. And so it's these very simple moves that we can give children the opportunity to perform them, that when they're little, that create, you know, kind of brain waves that they'll go back to when they're adults.
Right, where they're comfortable being uncomfortable and not knowing.
Right. They're comfortable investigating because, you know, when you're a kid, you don't know anything. So everything is an investigation and exploration. And when we get to be adults, I think oftentimes we expect ourselves to know everything already and don't have those opportunities to explore. You know, everything's on a schedule. And unfortunately, like a lot of childhood now has become on a schedule, and we don't give kids the opportunity to have an afternoon with materials to just explore. But that's really where kids start to understand themselves and start to understand how to try and fail and try again. And those are really the building blocks of an independent mind and a flexible mind.
So what are some of the things that we can do to make sure our kids are inquisitive and don't get that kind of pushed out of them by having to stick to such a strict schedule?
Well, I think the main thing is to give them opportunities to play, open-ended opportunities to play, and either materials or spaces that are inspirational. So, you know, the most basic thing is to have some kind of building toy in your house and an open area where kids can build things and maybe not have to put them away at the end of the day. You know, I'm a very tidy person, and I feel like when I had kids, I was constantly trying to put things away. But then as I began to do more reading, I found out, oh, actually, making kids put things away right away means that, you know, their investigation is necessarily curtailed. And really, they should be allowed to start building a city, add on to it the next day, take part of it down, you know, and that kind of evolution in their play is really important. And so kids need to have a space to perform play, and they need to have materials I've also written about cardboard box play. You know, you don't have to buy expensive things for this. Just save the boxes that you probably already have in your basement or in your recycling and let your kids play with them in the backyard, somewhere in your house. You know, tape and scissors and all of that. Like, cardboard is an incredibly flexible material, and it's really all they need to start making their own city.
Well, when I was reading that, I had this memory of myself at about, I don't know, 6 or 7, where I had a cardboard box. And when I was in that cardboard box, I was flying between planets. That was my, you know, I was going on trips and I was doing, and there's a picture of me somewhere doing just that, just out on the lawn.
Yeah, actually, people have started sending me pictures of themselves as children in cardboard boxes, which is awesome. That's the best kind of email to receive. But yeah, I remember, you know, when somebody in my neighborhood as a kid would get a new washing machine, it was the best day ever because that washing machine box was out in their yard and we all, you know, ran over and got markers and made it into a spaceship, made it into a house. It's so fun, and it's really, you know, kind of a primal form of play. So, yeah, I mean, that's all you need. But another thing that I talk about the books is just playgrounds, you know, at a slightly larger scale that are also inspirational that in that way. In the 1960s and 70s, there was a lot of experimentation with artist and architect design playgrounds that were really meant to kind of spark the imagination and provide a stage, and then children and their bodies and kind of communicating with each other provided the rest. And now a lot of the playgrounds that people install are all from catalogs. They all look a little bit alike, and that really curtails the possibility of, you know, what can happen on the playground.
You talk about, you know, having a physical emphasis and mm-hmm. the way children interact with their worlds and how the world interacts with them. We seem, you know, and I risk sounding like an old curmudgeon at this point, but we seem like we don't encourage just unfettered movement either. That, at least in this society, I mean, that may be different in other societies and different cultural norms, but, you know, everyone's glued to a cell phone or an Xbox or something like that. And so we're not out running through the woods or, you know, playing stickball on the streets or whatever, you know, environment that we grew up in 50 years ago. And of course, the world has changed. So how do we get kids to embrace that physicality?
Well, I think the first thing is we as adults need to give them, you know, more opportunities to do that and more room to do that. I mean, you mentioned playing stickball in the streets. The reason most kids don't do that anymore is because our streets have become wider, cars are going faster. It's not safe to kind of take over a road anymore. And I think we as a society really need to think about, you know, the space we're providing to cars versus the space we're providing to kids. Some cities have play streets programs that are basically saying, okay, you know, one Sunday a month, this street has no cars, and it becomes an instant playground. It becomes an instant community center. People can just kind of roll out their front doors and play in the street. And I think we need to see a lot more things like that that are pretty low cost and are kind of reclaiming territory. Another thing that I've talked a lot about is, you know, a lot of cities are building new parks, kind of destination parks, which is fabulous. But if there isn't a safe route from a lot of residential neighborhoods to those parks, then they become something that only happens once in a while. Kids can only go with their parents. And really, we need an opportunity for, you know, kind of kids to take play into their own hands, say, okay, I'm going to go meet my friends at the park. The reason kids are glued to screens is that they can say, I'm going to go meet my friends in, like, on our Minecraft server, right? They're at home, they're safe, but they're not moving their bodies. They are, I believe, having, you know, a social experience with those other kids in the Minecraft server, but they're not having a physical experience. And there isn't really an opportunity to add more people to that, as you might get in a park where other kids show up, you make friends. I mean, those social skills are really an important part of what we learn in childhood. And those also get curtailed when all of your interactions are kind of mediated by a teacher or a parent.
So when we talk about designing childhood, does class and race also play into the kinds of environments? I mean, I would assume yes, but do they, and in what ways may class and race make it better or worse?
Yeah, they play into it in a couple of different ways. One aspect is that I think children from lower income backgrounds often have more independence than children than from upper income backgrounds because their parents are working more and just don't have the opportunity to hover, which is ironic, but probably beneficial in the long run in a sense to those children because they do still play outside their houses. They do still have more of a sort of access to the neighborhood without parental supervision because those
decisions. Families
don't have choices.
Right.
And the choices they're making are, in fact, good choices, even though they may not perceive them as such. The other aspect is I talk in the book a lot about school design. And one of the things that was really interesting to trace was, you know, which children get access to new and progressive forms of education and new designs for classrooms first. And historically, those have been white upper income children. And in some cases, I talk about the Rosenwald schools, which were one and two room schoolhouses built across the South, starting in the early part of the 20th century. Those schools were built for Black children. And they had to be funded by the Black community, and they were purposely made to look lesser than the white schools. Because Booker T. Washington, who helped to establish the program, realized that if he created schools that looked as good as or better than white schools, there would be a problem. So new technologies in terms of classrooms have been offered to upper income and white children first. And I think that's still happening because school building is closely associated with the incomes of the community around them, so new school buildings are more likely to be built in upper-income communities.
Well, I want to wrap up with kind of a bigger picture question. If you could design a perfect environment for children, what would it look like?
Well, I think it would look something like a big empty room with a lot of blocks, but not just blocks in one size. Little blocks, big blocks, medium-sized blocks, and there would be a lot of them because the number one thing I learned in watching children play and researching all these, you know, historical forms of play is that it's really great to have a lot of something so you never feel like there's an end to your play. You're not going to run out. You don't have to fight over the last piece. Like, this sense of infinity is incredibly freeing, and children need more opportunities to just kind of go as far as they want to take it.
Well, Alexandra Lang, it has been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Alexandra Lang's book is called The Design of Childhood, How the Material World Shapes Independent Kids. Lang is a New York-based architecture and design critic, and she spoke with Bonnie North while she was in town to speak at the Milwaukee Art Museum as part of its exhibit called Serious Play, Design in Mid-Century America.